But it was a bit of a challenge because we were there at the radio station 25 minutes early. And because he said, you know, I want you to be there so we can kind of map out an outline. He showed up about 5 minutes before airtime. This is a live show. And so we had about 2 minutes to outline the show, and then he just abandoned the outline. And this producer says he does that all the time. He says 5 minutes is real early. He says usually he shows up just 90 seconds before he goes on the air. Frankly, I can't operate that way. But that evening, we did an event at Grace Chapel. That's one of the largest churches in the state of Massachusetts, which means it has about 2,000 members. And we had about 100 people come to our outreach event there. And it was sponsored by our Boston chapter. But I think what impressed me was just the number of PhD scientists that showed up. There was physicists, chemists, biologists, quite a number of neuroscientists, and they're all really eager to sign up and become part of the Boston chapter. That Boston chapter is really loaded with talent. I also got to meet the people who do a lot of the speaking and teaching for our Reasons to Believe Boston chapter, and they all have PhDs. There's a couple of physicists that do what I do. They go into churches and teach classes like this. It was a bit of a challenge because whenever we were driving, they would be in the car with me asking questions and trying to prepare their PowerPoints for their next lessons. So I didn't get to rest much in the car. But once again, what really helped that meeting, because it was about 100 people and about 40 of them were unbelievers. But we had probably half a dozen people testify publicly of how they came to faith in Christ through reading one of our books. So again, that really made it a lot easier to reach out to the unbelievers that were there. One of the things that came up at that meeting, it's actually what I want to talk about here in Job 40, is they told me, and this came from one of the non-Christians and several of the Christians, that the big challenge for Christians in the state of Massachusetts is that there's these atheists from the different universities who keep claiming that Christianity can't possibly be true because of all the bad designs in nature. And so we wound up spending about 40 minutes just talking about how do you deal with this charge of bad designs. And so I'm going to focus on that in the lesson here. It's right here in the book of Job, Job chapter 40. And in fact, I've been going on the internet and collecting from these atheist organizations all these examples of bad design. I thought you'd be amused by some of them. In fact, some of them have even shown up on Comedy Central. So we'll get to that in a minute, because I think it's important we be prepared to deal with that. Now, the next day, I spent almost the entire day writing, but also got to spend some time meeting with our chapter leaders, both from Boston and from Albany, New York. They drove all the way over to meet with us. Now what they're talking about is for Fuzz and I coming out probably sometime in the spring and doing one of our testable creation model presentations on Harvard campus and Brown University. They figure that Harvard would be a strategic place for us to roll out our testable creation model, where we invite prominent atheists to respond. And then Brown University they're selecting, that's in Providence, Rhode Island, which is about a 50-minute drive from Boston. But the reason they want to target Brown is that's where Ken Miller is. And Ken Miller has probably been the most vocal proponent of eliminating intelligent design and creation teaching from the public school arena. And he's a biologist, but very effective because he claims he's an evangelical Catholic. And so whenever he demolishes a creationist in a debate, he says, I'll pray for you. I'll pray for you every Sunday. I mean, he's really quite an arrogant guy. Well, he's a Roman Catholic who believes God exists, but that God sets up the universe, and then after that it's all man. He's basically a deist. He just basically says, you know, God sets it all up 13.7 billion years ago, and then he just lets all these natural processes that he designed in the beginning carry everything out there. So he really does believe that the origin of life takes place naturalistically, that there's no supernatural input for the origin of life, and there's no supernatural input for any of the history of life on planet Earth. It's all natural, including us human beings, which is a rather strange position for Catholics to take. Now, he has not yet stated what he does with the human spirit. He's kept quiet on that one. The official Roman Catholic position is that there is a miracle required to explain the spirit of humanity, but not necessarily miracles required to explain why we have the body we do or the soulish characteristics we do, but certainly our capacity to pray, for example, they would say is a miracle of God. But anyway, I'm impressed that our chapters back there in the East Coast really are going to be able to pull this stuff off. And they also want us to do at the same time a creation conference, probably in that Grace Chapel Church. It's the only church that would be large enough to accommodate what they believe will be the people who want to come from the New England area. Now, Sunday morning, this was last Sunday, I was in a place called Northview Church. It's not the largest church in Massachusetts, but it's the fastest growing church in Massachusetts. 2 years ago, it was just a couple of dozen people. Now they have 1,000 people. And what I was impressed with is that it's a church that's a lot like the churches I've been working with in the state of Washington. The state of Washington, like the state of Massachusetts, has extremely low church attendance. And so the churches in the state of Washington have tried to be rather creative. What they do is they eliminate most of the music, and certainly the congregational singing, and they replace that with drama and comedy and satire. And this Northview Church does exactly that, and it's set up in such a way that people who come to church can bring their food and drink right into the sanctuary, not a problem. I couldn't do that here at SMCC, but you can do it here in this room, right? Okay. But, you know, you'll actually see people bring their McDonald's bags in there, and they'll be eaten away. Their drama team is really outstanding. And Erdia does tend to put the non-Christians at ease, and so they get a lot of non-Christians that come. And what really made it easy for me is that they had a video clip of one of our chapter members just before they brought me on to speak. And it's a gal by the name of Beth Nichols, and she just gave a testimony of how she had been raised in Massachusetts, similar story. Her family is nominal Catholic, but nobody ever went to church, nobody ever read the Bible. And she got interested in science at an early age and grew up and became a science teacher. She teaches science at the grade 8 level. And then she talks about how she met this Christian who wanted her to come to this Northview Church. And she says, look, you don't understand. I teach science. I don't do anything that has anything to do with God. You know, science refutes God, and so, you know, I don't want to go to church. And then her Christian friend said, well, this church is different. You know, there's satire that goes on, and you can bring food and drink in, and they have this rock music band that comes in at the end, and this so blew away Beth. She says, well, the church has got that going, I just got to see it for its cultural impact. So she decided to go, and really liked the message of the pastor that he gave, and she talked to him afterwards, and she hit him with a whole bunch of questions. And so what really was shocking for her is that he was prepared to answer the questions. He says, my whole vision of church is it's filled with people who don't want to deal with any kinds of serious questions. And she had a whole bunch of questions on science, and he couldn't answer the questions, but her friend gave her the Genesis question. She read it, and she says, that's the book that brought me to faith in Christ and brought me into this church. And you can imagine, that went up there, and people rushing back to the book table. And within a few minutes, all the copies of the Genesis question were gone. So, but, you know, being able to speak right after that was really very easy for me. And also, what was interesting is that that particular Sunday, the church really drew a lot of scientists. Apparently, they really publicized this at the university campuses in the area. And we had a lot come, especially from MIT. We probably had a couple of dozen physicists and engineers that came from Lincoln Labs at MIT. And several of them were Christians. I mean, I spoke at MIT once before, and MIT is a lot like Caltech, and there's quite a few evangelical scholars that work and teach there. Well, MIT is similar. But the chapter was excited because they got 25 names from these people from Harvard and MIT and Lincoln Labs. So they're really excited. Well, what I thought I would do is just share with you. Oh, and by the way, when I came back, I did a couple of radio interviews on intelligent design. And again, just having finished this book and our little lessons we've been doing here in the Book of Job really prepared me for that. And it's amazing to me how Christians feel that we're between a rock and a hard place. We either are stuck with atheism, or we're stuck with some version of young earth creationism. And or we're stuck with what the intelligent design people do. They try to be completely religiously neutral. And just having the opportunity to explain on radio and on TV, I did one TV show, interesting TV show. I didn't have to go to the studio. They just put me on the phone. They put up a big picture of me on the on the screen and pictures of our books. It's an easy way to do TV. You don't have to put any makeup on or anything. I mean, it's great. Both of those things, what was really quite surprising for the hosts, as well as I believe the audience, is that the Supreme Court has not ruled against the teaching of creation because it's religious. They ruled against the teaching of creation because the brand of creation that was being presented had no provable scientific integrity or credibility. And what the Supreme Court said in those rulings is, you can come in with any model of creation, as long as it's got demonstrable scientific integrity and credibility, regardless of the theological implications. And so, kind of what's going in this book is what we Christians need to do is to become more religious, not less religious. The more religious we make our model, the more credible it becomes from a scientific perspective, and the court has already given us the guarantee that if our model is demonstrable scientific integrity, it's in regardless of its theology. And so making it more theological is actually a strength rather than a weakness. But I think the problem here is that Christians have been unwilling to admit that we lost all four court cases after the Scopes trial dealing with creation teaching because we had bad science. That's why we lost, not because we were being religious. We lost because we walked in with provably false science. And I think that's been very difficult for Christian leaders to admit that it was our fault, not the fault of the atheist judges. You know, everybody likes to say, well, it's because the judges were biased against the Christian worldview that we lost these cases. And what's going in this book is the fact that's not the problem. The fault is with the believers, not with the unbelievers. Yes. Well, in all four court cases, it was the young earth model that was being tried. They had their scientific case, but the problem was they brought in a number of witnesses, both Christians and non-Christians, who said this scientific case has no merit. This is false science. One geologist made the comment that he would find more credibility in the flat earth model than he would the young earth model. And then they brought some Christians forward and they said, yeah, we don't think this has any credibility either. And so what I was impressed with in going through the court proceedings is just how hard the justices and judges work at trying to find some secular credibility to what was being presented. But when they discovered they couldn't find any, then they brought forward a number of theologians and pastors to testify about whether or not this was a narrow religious perspective. And when it was shown that it was a religious narrow perspective, even within the narrow frame of evangelical Christianity, that's when they pulled out the First Amendment clause, the amendment to the first statement of the Constitution. That, this is a separation of church-state issue. And, from my opinion, having read the court case proceedings, and by the way, you can all read them for yourselves. They're now up on the web. And so you can go to the web and check it out for yourself. And, what you notice is that they only brought out the church-state issue when everything else had been shown not to be applicable. So it was a last resort. And as a last resort, they said, this is trying to promote a creation doctrine that comes from within a narrow perspective of the evangelical Christian community. therefore, if we were to mandate the legality of this, then it would mean that we would be favoring one or two denominations against the others. And they said that clearly violates the First Amendment to our Constitution. And I think they're right on the money. It does. Yes. I don't expect the Reasons to Believe model ever to go through the courts. There's no need for it to go through the courts. You know, we're arguing in this book that the courts have already ruled in favor of the model. The only thing that can kill our model is if it's shown to be scientifically false. So as long as we can demonstrate that, and by the way, the courts did not say it had to be perfect. They just said it had to have some demonstrable or secular integrity and credibility. After all, no model is perfect. And so if we can simply show that we're competitive with the models that are already being taught in the public education arena, then it's in. In fact, one of the things that happened, both in the state case with Louisiana and with the Supreme Court case, is the justice's first comment to the plaintiffs was, "Why are you here? You already have the right. There's no need for you to come before this court. The court has already given you the right." Well, what they discovered is that right was mandated on something that had provable secular integrity. So then they brought that forward. That's kind of what caused the whole thing to go by. But what they said in their initial statement was, the law of the land already gives the right to teachers to teach alternate models in the public school classroom with that one proviso. And what we're arguing in the book, too, is that this is not radical judicial action, that our country has always ruled against provably false scientific models as being able to be taught in the public school arena. An example I give two examples. Number one, you have the Flat Earth Society. Now, they're not very active today. Their president died a few years ago. But if you were to go back to the founding of this nation, back in, say, the 1770s, the Flat Earth Doctrine was a significant doctrine within the Christian community. And yet, at that time, you didn't have any school, Christian or non-Christian, teaching that in the science classroom. It never happened. Why? Because it had no secular integrity or credibility, so it never got taught. And it says another example that's valid even to this day is geocentrism. There's still significant portions of the Christian community that believe that the Earth is the center of the solar system, the Earth is the center of our galaxy. There's another version of it that says the galaxy is the center of the universe. So this is being taught within the Christian community, and yet we don't see it in any of the science curriculum. Why? Because, again, it falls into that category of having no secular integrity or credibility. So my whole point is, the law of the land has been consistent with what the courts have ruled on all these issues. It's no different. 200 years ago, they were ruling against provably false models. Today, they're ruling against provably false models. And would any Christian really want provably false models to be taught in defense of their faith? In the back. Well, that's a very good point. You know, why do we have the Darwinian evolutionary model taught when its integrity is certainly in question? Well, parts of the Darwinian model you can show have scientific credibility and integrity. The problem is it's been a model that hasn't had any decent competition. The only competition I've seen within secular circles comes out of the Santa Fe Institute, which is to say it's chaos theory instead of Darwinian evolution. And there again, what I'm doing in this book that we're bringing out is saying, just like with the court cases, it's our fault. We Christians have not produced the necessary competition to really show the failings of the Darwinian model. And the whole point is to try to convince Christians that you cannot expect scientists to dump their Darwinian model until they see a model to take its place that's got superior explanatory power and superior predictive success. And, you know, one of the things I'm calling out in the book is the fact that Christians have the reputation in the scientific community have been nothing but evolution bashers. That's one of the main criticisms of the intelligent design movement. All they offer are negative arguments against the Darwinian model. They don't produce positive arguments for their model. So what we're arguing in the book is we Christians need to produce our model, give positive evidences for it, and I believe the byproduct of that is it will force the agnostics and the atheists to come up with a model that's more complete than what they have. I mean, you look at the Darwinian model, they never really address the question of how mutations and natural selection can produce the claimed results under the conditions that planet Earth provides in the time frame that it provides. They never really put the numbers in to see whether this is a reasonable outcome. Now, why haven't they done that? Because nobody has produced a model that does that with a different perspective. So, it does, but that will not be exposed, in my opinion, until we Christians produce an adequate competing model. And by the way, we're not claiming ours is the only model. We're also trying to encourage Christians to produce models from a Christian perspective that would compete with a reasons to believe model. But one of the reasons why I believe the evolutionists have had the day, they've had no competition. You've got to give them some competition. And I think this will be good for them because, you know, they admit there's holes in their models, but they've really had, say, well, there's nothing else out there that deals with these holes either. And, you know, that's certainly been true with what they've had to face from the Christian community up to this point. Yes. Well, we're also arguing in this book that we Christians should not try to overthrow the system in the sense that I think it would be a mistake if we were to try to say, let's dump all their science textbooks and replace them with our textbooks. You know, that might come down the road, but what we're arguing is there's much within the science textbooks in the public education arena that's really worthy material. What we need are supplemental texts that will deal with those parts of those textbooks where we see serious scientific flaws. To give you an example, every high school biology textbook has got a little section in it on the origin of life. And it's based on this old Carl Sagan idea that there was this vast primordial soup that filled the oceans of planet Earth. And it was this thick, rich broth of all the molecules that you need for building life systems, like amino acids and sugars and you know, nitrogenous bases. All that was in there. And if you let it percolate for a billion years, these amino acids and nitrogenous bases and the sugars will assemble themselves into proteins, DNA, and RNA. And the lipids will come about and make the membranes, and that will become the simplest life form from which we're all evolved. Now, that's kind of the story. You'll find it in every high school biology textbook. Well, now we have a book that's been out for a year. It's out there on the table, Origins of Life, which makes the point that those statements on which the naturalistic origin of life model are based have been proven to be incorrect by new scientific discoveries. And so we're saying, why don't you bring this book in to supplement your high school biology textbook, and when you get to the section on the origin of life, you can say, here's some updated material that gives a completely opposite conclusion. What Christians can do and parents can do is simply alert their local school boards that this kind of material is available. Now, if you start arguing for an overthrow of the textbooks, you're going to meet with a lot of resistance. Why? Because the school boards have invested a lot of money and time in those textbooks. And these textbooks have been through major revisions. In fact, you know, I've got a number in my office. If you pick up the biology textbook, I'd say 99% of it is really sound material that in no way offends a Christian worldview perspective. Keep that 99%. The teachers are already trained to teach it. It's well-written material. In my opinion, there's way too much there for a high school kid to pick up. I mean, these books keep getting thicker and thicker. But, you know, it's good stuff, but there are a few sections in it where they talk about the origin of life, where they talk about panspermia, where they talk about all life being descended from Luca, last universal common ancestor. That stuff needs to be corrected. Now, what really makes it easy for us to do that is we're not the only ones saying it must be corrected. The atheist and agnostic science researchers who are up to date in the latest scientific discoveries also acknowledge that there's a problem there. That we now know that there's never been a primordial soup on planet Earth. Carl Sagan was dead wrong on the oceans having all these molecules in them. And we also know that the origin of life took place in a geological instant, not over a billion years. Now, just simply getting that across into the biology curriculum will make a difference. So, yeah. Well, this book that I just sent to the publisher addresses another problem that I think is a big, and by the way, this is what caused a lot of internal discussion about what form this book should take, is that there's a lot of censorship going on, and you say, you know, why doesn't Reasons to Believe show up, say, in the state of Kansas or the state of Ohio? The truth is, we tried. We tried really hard to get in front of the state school boards, both in Ohio and Kansas. You know who kept us out? It was the Christians. They did not want us there. They wanted to push their young earth model or their ID model, and when they heard that we were prepared to come, they moved quickly to stop us from coming. Well, you say, how do you get around that? I think it's grassroots. You know, just like the textbook thing. The way you get, and by the way, for what it's worth, three of our books there on the table are in the public school arena. Not all of public schools, but it's been grassroots people who've gotten things like The Creator and the Cosmos and The Origins of Life book into the public schools. And the thing I've noticed is every time it's been presented, there's never been an objection. Now, if you read those books, it talks very forthrightly about the Christian faith in Jesus Christ in particular. And yet, we've had no problems or complaints about it being there as a supplemental text. Now, I think we would get a big reaction if we were to say, we want the physics textbook replaced by The Creator and the Cosmos, and we want the biology textbook replaced by The Origins of Life. Yeah, then you're going to get a big reaction. But as a supplement, and correcting something that everybody admits is false, no problem. You'll get that in. So, now, obviously not every teacher or school board is going to go along with it. There'll be atheist teachers that say, gee, this is overtly Christian, I don't want to use it. But fine, some will use it, then the word gets out. It's got to be grassroots, in my opinion. And that's how we're going to be able to break through the atheistic objection, but also break through the Christian objection. And that's why we've purposely designed Reasons to Believe from the get-go to be dominated by volunteers, not by staff. I mean, Reasons to Believe is 35 paid staff and 3,500 volunteers. And so it's volunteers that are really going to make the difference. Now, will 3,500 do it? No, I think we're going to need 35,000. So, but hey, the chapters are growing. That can happen. Hey, can we get into the lesson? Yeah, go ahead. If it's one page, why don't we just make copies and make it available to everybody? Yeah, that'd be good. Sure. Yeah. Well, I mean, what Jeff Marcy is involved in is another, I think, opportunity for textbooks. What I'm seeing more and more is when you get into physics and astronomy, what's coming to the high school textbooks is this idea of SETI, the search for extraterrestrial intelligent life, and this idea that there's all these planets out there with life on it, and many of those planets with life on it have intelligent life on it. Well, there's some very good science we can bring to bear to critique those three perspectives. But is it in the public education arena? No, it's not. So I think there's some real opportunities for us to take that on. Okay, let's get into our lesson. Chapter 40, and I think this is very apropos for what we're talking about and also what happened when I was in the state of Massachusetts. Chapter 40 begins with a statement. The Lord said to Job, and not just to Job, but to all of his friends that were gathered. There's five men gathered here. He says, "Will the one who contends with the Almighty correct him? Let him who accuses God answer him." Now, when Job heard this, he repented. He said, I'm unworthy. How can I reply to you? I put my hand over my mouth. I spoke once, but I have no answer. Twice, but I will say no more. Now, I think this is apropos because what we were dealing with in the state of Massachusetts was this idea, the Christian God can't be the one that created the universe or life or human beings, because if we're talking the Christian God, he wouldn't create life with all these bad designs in it. Well, isn't this exactly what we were seeing here in these chapters in Job, is that these five men are debating one another and they're calling into question why God does the things the way he does it. Basically, they're saying God doesn't really know as much as I know about how to do things. And that's what I hear from people who claim, like Stephen Gould, that there's bad designs in nature. They're saying, you know, you Christians worship this God, but, you know, I'm smart enough to realize that this is a bad design. Your God can't be a very decent God if he can't, you know, design anything better than this. So, I got a list here of, and I pulled this off the internet, of bad designs in nature that atheists use to prove that the Christianity can't be possibly be correct. And it's not my intent that you be equipped to answer all these charges of bad design, because what I told the group there in Massachusetts, the problem is if you develop very good answers for all these bad designs in nature, they'll come up with other ones. And so what you need to do is develop some general principles for dealing with these charges of bad design. Otherwise, they will always keep you on the defensive. And you know, how can you get off the defensive and really deal with this? But in terms of what's out there, you know, Stephen Gould wrote a book in 1981 about designs in nature, basically making the charge that they're all bad designs. And the book was titled Panda's Thumb. And he that was kind of his primary example of a bad design in nature, that the thumb of the panda was a very clumsy device, and you know, this is something that you could not attribute to a God that's all-powerful and all-intelligent. Another one is the human appendix. And it wasn't too long ago, those of you that are older probably can remember that when anybody had abdominal surgery, they automatically took out the appendix. Why? Because the medical constituency saw the human appendix as being a holdover from evolution. You know, we evolved from the apes, and one of the things that happens as you naturally evolve is you wind up with these organs that have no purpose and no function. And so from that evolutionary perspective, and this went on, by the way, for almost 100 years, where they would just routinely take out the appendix anytime they opened up your abdomen. And now they don't do that anymore. They finally discovered why we all have an appendix. It really does serve a useful purpose. Well, I'll get to it in a minute, okay? Why, don't you have your appendix anymore? Well, another one you've probably heard of, this is very popular, is the human tailbone. You know, all of us have this little tailbone at the base of our spine, and the thought was, well, you know, we obviously evolved from the apes, and they have long tails, and what happened is we evolved as the tail got shorter and shorter, and this little tailbone we have is the leftover piece of evolution for the human species. Okay, another one that's related to that is the fact that our backbone has kind of a slight S shape to it, And they said, you know, that's really a bad design for a creature that's going to be bipedal. Why would we have that crazy shape? And when I saw in the Los Angeles Times a couple of weeks ago in the comics section was male nipples. And, you know, that's Charles Darwin brought that one up. That, you know, what possible purpose do male nipples serve? And this is a bad design not only for us human beings, it's a bad design for all these mammalian creatures. They all got these useless nipples. So what do you do with that? And one that was on the Jon Stewart show, my sons watch Comedy Central, so they're the one that told me about this, and it was actually pretty embarrassing. They had one of the leaders of the intelligent design movement on that show. It was the guy from Texas. Marge, you might be able to help me with this. The guy who's done all this stuff on the design filter, the design inference. Yeah, Bill Dembski. He was on the show. And, of course, you know, Comedy Central just loves to ridicule and humiliate Christians. And the one Jon Stewart came up with is the fact that the human scrotal sac has this paper-thin skin over it. And he said, you know, you claim it's intelligent design. That's a terrible design from my perspective. And there was no answer forthcoming. Some others I've seen on the net are the fact that carnivores really aren't as lethal as it could be if God had really designed them to be more lethal. Likewise with parasites, that there's bad designs in parasites because they could actually be more effective and productive if they were just a little more lethal. And then another one are the fact that herbivores have rather poor defenses against carnivorous attack. And then the one that was brought forward as probably one of the biggest examples, plants. You know, look how badly plants are designed that they can't defend themselves a little better against herbivores. So these herbivores come along and just eat them all. And that's got to be a bad design. So, but going back here to the book of Job, says, well, the one who contends with the Almighty, correct him. Let him who accuses God answer him. And I got a little sentence here in my Bible here. How dare we call God's actions and motives into question when we lack so much knowledge and understanding of the phenomena? And so, you know, pick any one of these. The panda's thumb. You know, Gould called it a terrible design. Well, how well do we understand the dynamics and the design of the panda's thumb? And before you call this into question, shouldn't you gain a little more understanding here? Or the appendix. You know, for 100 years, the medical community assumed the appendix was useless. And I think it's because they assumed that the appendix serves some kind of function in digestion. It turns out it serves no function for digestion. That doesn't mean it doesn't serve any function at all. And so many of these examples of bad designs is just that. They have too narrow a perspective and where the design must lie, and the design lies over here. Yeah, but the answer God gives to Job and his friends is, you know, before you correct me, do you really think you've got as much knowledge and understanding as I have? You know, I'm the creator. And you're calling things into question you don't fully understand. Well, I drew up a list of questions for, and I did this on the cuff when I was in Massachusetts. When I got back, I said, you know, I think this will work. When you get hit with something like this, you might say, well, gee, I'm not a medical doctor. I have no idea what purpose the appendix serves, or I know nothing about the panda's thumb and male nipples. Gee, I just don't know. And bad design. Okay, how well do you understand this organ, this appendage, this feature, and its relationship to other functions and organs and appendages in the body? So in other words, you just put them on the defensive. And the whole point is this. Could it be that there are hidden designs that we've not yet discovered for this appendix, this S-shape of the backbone, this paper-thin covering for the male scrotal sac? Is that possible? And the answer, obviously, will be it's always possible. You can only rule it out as being impossible if you claim that you have complete understanding of the human body, and no one would ever say that. Then you could say, in light of bad design judgments in the past, is it not wise to learn more about this system before judging the quality of its design? In other words, I think it's good for Christians to be equipped to answer at least one or two of these. Then you can always say that. Well, you know, we've made some bad judgments in the past about the appendix, and we discovered it had a very good purpose, and therefore, when we come up with a new example, shouldn't we take a lesson from what we had experienced in the past? There's been all kinds of bad designs that have been fingered in the past, and when we studied them in sufficient depth, we discovered they were all good designs. Now you got a new one, shouldn't we at least be cautious? But I think it's the best thing of all to propose a test. Okay, you look at this as a bad design. How about if we do an experiment? We'll isolate this particular problem, say the appendix, and we're going to charge the medical research community to do more research on the appendix. And if we're talking a Christian perspective, we would predict that additional research will uncover more evidence for design, but if you're coming up from an atheistic perspective, you would predict that additional research will find less evidence for design. Now that's a test you could propose in any situation. Okay, we have this supposed bad design, let's research it more, and as we research it, let's see which way the evidence goes. Does the evidence for bad design go up, or does the evidence for bad design go down? You don't even have to argue for good design, just say, does the evidence for bad design increase or decrease as we learn more and more about the system? Okay, you probably want me to give you a few answers for this. The appendix was the first, and for 100 years, everybody looked at the appendix and they could find no way that it facilitated the human digestive system. And therefore, they always cut it out because it had this nasty habit of getting inflamed every once in a while. And so they would just cut it out routinely. Well, scientists now know that the appendix, although it serves no function for the human digestive system, does serve an important function for the human immune system. And therefore, surgeons no longer remove the appendix unless it really is inflamed, because they realize it does serve this purpose. And by the way, they've also discovered that there are certain dietary changes that you can institute that will significantly lower the probability that your appendix will get inflamed and have to be removed. And so there is now a move within the medical community to work with their patients so that they have a lifestyle where it's not going to lead to their appendix getting inflamed and possibly ruptured. Why? Because the appendix is something you want to hang on to. Yeah, you can live without it, but your immune system won't be as effective without it as with it. And therefore, if you take good care of your digestive tract, then you've got a higher likelihood of keeping your appendix for the rest of your life. So, but keep in mind, for 100 years, they thought the appendix had no purpose whatsoever, and the best thing for everybody is just to have the thing removed. In fact, there's even talk about that. The operation is so simple. I remember my mother, she was a surgical nurse, and said they were doctors actually talking about that. You know, let's just routinely get rid of everybody's appendix, and we'll take care of this bad design issue. Yes. Right. Right. Yet there was a time when they thought the tonsils and the adenoids were useless. So, that's true. But what this has done is had a positive influence on the entire medical research community. In other words, because of the mistakes we made with the tonsils and the appendix and the adenoids, they're now very careful to look at any part of the human body and declare it to be a bad design. For example, the tailbone. We now realize that the tailbone really does fulfill a vital role in maintaining our capacity to be bipedal. Now, the S shape and the tailbone could be better designed if we never sat down. But the problem is we humans sit a lot, okay? And so if you were simply upright all the time, always bipedal, so that you're always walking on 2 feet, yeah, you could look at better designs. But see, our human backbone is not only designed so that we can walk and run and stand, it's also designed so we can sleep and sit. The other thing that we note is it's designed that it can carry a load. And so, you know, that's one of the things about being a human, is that our backs are able to take, say, a 60-pound load on your back, and you can still be okay. Well, this requires a little bit of a spring in the backbone, and also requires this tailbone to give you adequate balance. And so it's one thing to be able to balance your body when you're carrying no weight. It's quite another thing to balance your body if you are carrying a weight. And like this young lady here, she's carrying a weight, okay? You need to be able to, and that's the other thing, you know, if you're pregnant, that puts a different stress on the backbone. The way the human backbone is designed, it can handle that. Now, one thing they have discovered is that the human backbone actually has a higher degree of functionality if we were like 5 to 5.5 feet tall rather than 6 to 6.5 feet tall. So the increasing height of the human species is posing a problem, but hey, that's only been in literally the last 100 years that we've been exceeding the ideal height for our species. Yes. Well, if you do make, there are people who have said that we would be better off having fewer vertebrae that were longer, thicker vertebrae, a straighter back. I mean, these things are the typical things that are being brought out. But again, the fallacy there is presuming that the human backbone structure has a rather limited set of purposes. And that's why I've made the point. We not only have the ability to walk, to run, to stand, and by the way, it's more difficult to stand than it is to walk or run. My back hurts a lot more if I'm standing in one spot for several hours than it is if I walk for 10. That's very stressful on the human back. But the other thing is that our backs are rather flexible, so we can crawl when we want to, and we can kind of go up very difficult passages if we need to, and running requires a lot more flexibility in the back than walking does. And so if you want to have that kind of flexibility, then you're going to want to have many vertebrae rather than a few vertebrae. And you're going to want lots of sponginess between it. But one of the risks of that is you overload the back, then you can damage that spongy material between the vertebrae. You can crush the vertebrae. And part of the problem there is that, now that we're into the 21st century with a technological lifestyle, there are stresses on the human back that the human back has not faced for the past 50,000 years. But that's the other thing, is that when God designs, he's working on an optimal design, and often optimal designs require compromises. So again, you go back from the perspective of the Creator. He needs to design the human back in such a way that it's going to be maximally useful for the human species, not just in a technologically advanced society, but over the past 50,000 years of human existence. And again, our capacity to carry loads, and to carry loads where you've got a front load as well as a back load, a high load and a low load, being able to use a shovel, an axe, this all puts different stresses on the back, and therefore you want a back that's more flexible than what those skeptics suggest. Yes. Right. Right, right. Yeah, that's a good point. It's there's both sides. And often the skeptic is failing to recognize that ideal designs do require compromises. I'll give you an example. You can buy an automobile that has very high performance, or you can buy an automobile that has very good gas mileage. You're not going to be able to buy an automobile that has both high performance and good gas mileage. Now, what you can buy is an automobile that makes a compromise. where you get decent gas mileage, but also decent performance. But it's not going to have as good a gas mileage as the top gas mileage vehicles out there, or as good a performance as the top performance vehicles out there. And again, that's kind of my point here about the human backbone, is that the human backbone has been designed by God to undertake functions over a wide spectrum of possible usages. And therefore you come up with, quote, a compromise design that enables us to survive, say, a Bushman-type lifestyle, where you're running after game and trying to kill him, and without the benefit of shoes. That requires a different kind of backbone design than you would sitting at a desk looking at a computer screen for 12 hours a day. So, taking into that context, and again, you can always ask the question, how well do you understand this pack? And here's a good example. You know, 50 years ago, they said the tailbone's a bad design, the S-shape is a bad design. You don't have people who are medical researchers saying that anymore. They now recognize the tailbone is an excellent design, also the S-shape is an excellent design, and therefore you can get into other details of the backbone. You can just use those past examples and say, now wait a minute, you might think the cartilage could be designed a little better. But before you make that judgment call, let's learn from the past. We used to say that about the tailbone. We used to say that about the S-shape. Therefore, let's be a little more cautious before we claim that this is the case. And also, I think part of the blame, as I mentioned already, is that because of our lifestyle, we now have taller individuals than we had in the past. And I would argue that our backbone structure is much better designed for something like a 5'6" individual than it is for a 6'6" individual. We got a few people here that are approaching 6'6", so I imagine you suffer more from back. I mean, what's really interesting, not yet. Okay, if you read the history, what you'll discover was that the Roman army would march 4.25 miles for 12 hours a day, and they could do that day in and day out and not need a rest. Now that was kind of what the Roman army was able to do. They could march these enormous distances, you know, literally that many hours a day, and they could fight a battle the next day and win. And they could carry 100-pound packs. Okay? But they were only 5 feet tall. You're 5 feet tall, you can do that. You cannot get an army of 6-footers to do that. You know, and this is something they noticed, is that in World War II, they had to drop the weight of the pack that the soldiers carried from what they had in World War I. World War I, they were carrying much more weight than they were in World War II. The difference was, in World War II, they're working with taller soldiers, and so they had to drop their weight down. That seems kind of counterintuitive. You figure the bigger the soldier, the more weight he can carry. Actually, because of the way the backbone is designed, it goes the other way. But you know, if you don't really look into all these different features, you might look at it and say, gee, that's a bad design. So, yes. Get to the male nipples? Okay. I'll eventually get through this whole list. I don't think I'm going to get through the whole list today, but let me take a stab at getting started at the male nipples. And to realize that any three-dimensional body must have seam points. In fact, if you look very carefully at your body, you'll discover that there's quite a few seam lines and seam points. Okay? And one of the purposes of the nipples is it provides seam points. Now, the female obviously has to have the nipples and the breasts. But the male needs seam points too. And one of the principles from a Christian perspective, again we can pull it here, the book of Job, is the economy of design. Okay, God designs things in such a way that he can repeat his designs. While it would make sense just in terms of the economy of design, that if you have to have these breasts and nipples for the female, why don't you just economize a design and put the seam points on the male the same place you put them on the female? You got to have them anyway. So it'd be, to me, a mark of bad design if you had the seam points, say, here and here, instead of here and here. Because now you've got to have an extra design you've got to put into the human species to distinguish between the male and the female. Let's put them in the same spot. Okay, That's one answer you can give. Another answer you can give is that the male nipples aren't exactly useless. It's not just a seam point. Like with the female, you'll notice that there's a lot of nerves that are associated with the male nipples, just like with the female nipples, that plays a role as an erogenous zone. And you know, I won't get into this today, there isn't time. Or need, I think, saved by the bell on that one, right? Well, one of the problems with the human species, I know you're kidding, but there's actually is a serious point here, is that one of the problems with the human species is simply maintaining our population level. And so what you notice with the human species is that it's much more highly sexed in terms of sexual stimulation than other species are. That's vital to maintain our survival, especially in a high affluence, high technology civilization. And so there are sexual stimulants that are built into the human species you don't see in other species. Why? Because other species don't have the distractions that we face based on our civilization and technology. Remember we had that debate once about how there's all these babies that are born during power outages? But you have a power outage, that takes away all the distractions, and so you get more babies being born. Yes. That's true. So, yeah. That's true. I mean, you look at the platypus. To me, it's God wanting to show us just how creative he can be. I mean, you know, people looked at them. In fact, I could have added that to my list, the platypus, because that's been earmarked as a bad design. And that was earmarked as a bad design again for over 100 years. They now realize the way the platypus feeds, you have to have this combination of mammalian features and bird features. And so that duck-billed thing really does serve a very good purpose based on its feeding habits. But until those feeding habits were researched thoroughly, everybody looked at the platypus and said, there's a mistake of evolution if I ever saw one. And now we realize it's a really an elegant design. Yes. Well, the family I stayed with in Boston, the wife was pregnant with twins. So yes, there are times when it's helpful to have two breasts instead of one breast. Okay? Okay, why do you have to have seam lines? Okay, you have all these internal organs, and guess what surrounds all these internal organs and appendages? Skin. Okay, that skin has to have a place where it seams. If you're trying to enclose something, you've got to have a seam, like a football. Okay, if you're going to make a football, it's got to have a seam in it. If you have a basketball, it's got to have a seam in it. And likewise, with the human body, there must be seams. And I think what, you know, actually I wrote up a little piece on male nipples, not for this book, but for the next book I'm working on. And the whole point is when you look at the human body, the way the seam lines and the seam points are designed, it's very efficient in terms of just how much genetic material you need to support the enclosure of the human body. And yeah, a lot of it has to do with development. It's not just enough that you have this skin. It's got to be an expandable skin. And the skin you have when you're in the embryo isn't the same as the skin you have when you're born. There's a big difference. And the skin's got to last a long time. And the seam points have to remain intact during that time. You know, the whole point about avoiding hernias. You want the skin structured and the seam structured in such a way that you're not going to have too many herniation events taking place. Incidentally, there's seams inside the body. So if you look at the organs and the way they're structured, you actually see seam points there as well. But again, how well do we understand all this? There's a lot more research needs to be done there. But from my perspective, it's remarkably efficient and elegant the way these seams are developed. But this is something that skeptics really haven't considered. You know, they just think, hey, God could easily make a body without seam points at all. Well, no, if you really think about it, He can't do that. Can we enclose things without seams? We can't do it. Yes. Well, they would claim that the more advanced the species, then the more evolutionary baggage you'll carry from the species you're descended from. So in the evolutionary model, they would predict that the later the species shows up in the fossil record and the more advanced it is in nature, the more bad designs would accumulate. Well, they would say that, you know, mammals evolve from other vertebrate species, which evolve from invertebrate species, and there were these accidents of evolution, mutations. And so how do we get nipples? Well, fundamentally, it boils down to some mutation way deep in the evolutionary past. And because mutations are accidents, there will be some that serve no purpose. Now, the evolutionary model argues that if the bad design is detrimental, then natural selection will get rid of it. Because if you wind up having to pay a cost for that bad design, it would simply be weeded out. But they look at male nipples as something that doesn't cost much. I mean, there's not that much weight involved, and so they say there really isn't the evolutionary pressure to get rid of that bad design. But their actual prediction is that we humans would have more bad designs in it than less advanced species, because we're the latest on the scene, we're the most advanced, we should have the most bad designs. That really explains why the medical profession for so long thought tonsils, adenoids, male nipples, the appendix, that these were all bad designs, because after all, we're at the end of the evolutionary line, we should have the most bad designs. But I find it interesting now that the medical profession is very humble in the context of looking at the human body and saying it's loaded with bad designs. I think they've learned a lesson. We just need that lesson to permeate a little further down. Okay, I'll cover some of these other bad designs next week, as well as some strategies on how to deal with it when this issue comes up. Because my experience in the state of Massachusetts kind of has convinced me this is going to be an increasingly potent argument coming from the evolutionary community. It seems like they have a strategy. This is what I learned in Boston, is that the atheists and agnostics there have looked upon this as a strategy to go after the Christian worldview perspective. Let's just hit them with so many bad designs they don't know what to do with them all. So we need to develop a good counter strategy to deal with that. But I like your comment. Let's start hitting them with all the good designs that are out there. And let's propose tests. I mean, likewise with the good designs, we would predict that the more we learn about the good designs, the better they're going to look. And incidentally, I'll talk about this next week, there is room within the Christian perspective for a limited amount of bad designs. Okay, so we'll get to that. All right. Father in heaven, we want to thank you for the day and age in which we live. We thank you for all the knowledge that we've gained, the understanding that we have gained. But Father, I pray you would bless us with the spirit of humility you poured upon Job and Elihu. Lord, that we would follow their examples and we see things we don't understand or fully appreciate, that we would be slow to call your handiwork into question and quick to question our capacity to really understand everything that is there. Father, I pray that you would grant us the grace and the wisdom to deal with these challenges to our Christian worldview model in a way that will help people to understand the glory and the majesty and the righteousness of the one that has created the universe. Thank you, Lord, for all that you've given us the capacity to learn. Help us to use it for your purpose and glory. In Jesus' name, amen.